Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right, we are in studio. We got a full house here today. You've tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we're in studio with a number of generations of America's top chefs, if you will, or non-American top chefs. We want to go around the room and get some introductions because we got a lot of folks here. Over directly across from me, Jimmy Sneed. Jimmy, welcome to the studio.
Hello, thank you so much.
Thanks for coming in. And then, of course, our founder and fearless leader, Patrick Martins.
Thanks for not shutting me out of this interview.
Well, we'll see about that.
It's not over yet.
And then Gunter Seeger. Gunter, welcome to Heritage.
Thank you.
And Jonah Roadhamel, all the way from CA. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. And then his lovely lady, Jessie Badass, is what I wrote on my thing here, but I think I wrote that wrong.
It's okay. That's my superhero name.
Awesome. Badly, right?
Badly.
Badass Badly. So we kind of had an alignment of stars and got everyone in the studio today. I wanted to chat a little bit about the food scene through the generations. Jimmy, you worked with Jean-Louis Paladin back in the day. What was that like? How did you end up in that spot? What was it like? Because I heard he was kind of like a little bit of a artistic leader, a little bit of a womanizer, and very French. He yelled a lot.
A leader, a womanizer, and a screamer.
That's what I heard. That's what I heard. So, I mean, you can set
that's
the record
how you
straight.
Just describe Jean-Louis Paladin.
That's what I heard. That's why I wanted to have you come in and like get the real story. Because, you know, maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but, you know, that's just what I heard.
He was a screamer. He was very passionate. I was lucky enough to get a job with him, I think really only because I speak French. I didn't really know how to cook, but he didn't care. He would either make a cook out of me or drive me away. But I do remember the first night in the kitchen when one of the waiters came into the kitchen and said, Jean-Louis, if you don't stop screaming, we have a table of customers that say they're going to leave. And he said, I don't care! So I thought, yeah, this is going to be a fun ride.
And how long were you working with him?
Well, I worked with him for a year and a half, and then I quit because I was tired of getting screamed at every night. And then I went to work for probably the other great chef of our time, Gunter Seeger,
who happens to be in studio with us here,
who happens to be sitting next to us.
So I have a question. I want to ask.
I'm not done.
Wait a second. Why the greatest chef of our time? You cannot drop those words and not back them up. Which, you know, I agree with you. But Jean-Louis Paladin, Gunter Seeger, you have to contextualize them a little bit for our listeners who might not understand how maybe the terrain was different back then.
The fuck does contextualize mean?
Just okay. Be a storyteller. I know you can do that.
At the time, I started with Jean-Louis in 81. I worked with Gunther in probably 85. At the time, they were the only two Michelin-rated chefs in America. Of course, Jean-Louis being from France, he had two Michelin stars. Gunther being from Germany had one Michelin star, which means if the French are going to give a German one star, he's worth at least two, maybe three. And so I got an opportunity to see. I got to tell you, being in Jean-Louis' kitchen, which was about the size of this studio, and by the way, the six of us are very cramped in here, that was about the size of Jean-Louis' kitchen. And I have no idea what I was about to say. Anybody?
Well, maybe.
Oh, other chefs.
Yeah.
Other chefs from all over the country would come in and stand in the corner just to watch Jean-Louis cook. I remember this 24-year-old kid. I hope he went on to do great things. He would stand in, Daniel Boulou.
Oh, Oh, I've heard of him, yeah.
Yeah,
he's got a restaurant in the city, right?
Maybe. And, well, then good for him. He used to come in the kitchen just to watch Jean-Louis cook and became great friends with Jean-Louis out of this incredible respect for what Jean-Louis was doing. Passionate, yes. Womanizer.
I'm not asking to blow up his spot.
Six or eight women a week. I don't know if you call that a big deal or not, but yeah, he was passionate. And people ask me all the time, you know, was he that great and what made him so great? And I'm quick to respond. I think that his passion for cooking and his sexual energy worked side by side. I think there was a real connection.
And, well, meanwhile, Gunther, you were down in Atlanta, so how does, like...
No, I was in D.C. then.
Oh, you were in D.C. then,
and
okay.
I have to add something to this.
Yes, please.
I think we need to also come to a place where we understand that people like Jean-Louis are really were the force and of the culinary, what you see of today. I mean, I think too many people forget, and their memories are very short. And because when Jean-Louis came, or when I personally came in the mid-80s and where we are today, there was a lot of work in between. There was a lot of work in educating farmers and growers and the food side. And there was also a very big force into educating customers and employees. And so on. So we need to understand where what we have today, there are few pioneers 30 years ago, maybe we can say, who have created a lot what you have today. And it is unfortunately many times, you know, we're talking about where we are. Well, today we went through a revolution, and today in America, we have some of the greatest restaurants in the world. We have some of the greatest producers of, you know, anything, what you needed to have a great restaurant. But there was a start to that. And so let's not forget.
So you would say that start was happening around that time? And what?
Oh, it definitely started. It definitely started in Jean-Louis' time. And I came a little bit later. Because we, you know, at that time, you only had a few very traditional French chefs in New York. And I even would say at that time that Washington, D.C. actually was culinarily better than New York. So see where we are today. See where California is. I mean, see everywhere where we are. It's not only New York anymore. I mean, it's all over the country. We have seen huge steps toward where we are today.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Were you nervous about leaving Europe for a new country? Because, I mean, you can liken it almost to the pilgrims, you know, the pioneers. There wasn't much precedent for leaving and trying to start a Michelin restaurant in the U.S.
Well, I can tell you in 1977 when I opened my restaurant in Germany, that was the same thing. That was a pioneer work. And so you go through that, and then it's, you know, it's a challenge. And there are jobs, there are offers, there are challenges you know people offer you and you go for.
And I mean, speaking of that transition and that period, I mean, Jonah, you're out in Oakland, California, and you've taken over the kitchens at Oliveto, and obviously got to work under a variety of great chefs. But what would you say is like kind of the importance of the historical context that we're kind of chatting about?
And let me just contextualize, Oliveto is a historic restaurant. I mean, that goes Paul Bertoli. Bertoli was one of Alice Waters' favorite disciples. And so it also comes from American history, started from within. Because, you know, all the great traditions come from New York or the South, but there's this one cuisine that, you know, Alice Waters and Chez Panisse had a big part, you know, that came from the West to the rest of the country, you know, almost like eating in season and all that. It's like an American-made tradition. So anyway, just Oliveto is an important restaurant, too.
Yeah, definitely carrying on with that. Oliveto has been open for 25 years now, and there's a lot of tradition that I kind of have inherited with that, with Oliveto. people actually still think Bertoli's the chef, which is kind of amusing when I go out into the dining room. And
you look a little different than him.
Slightly. People do get Bob confused with Bertoli.
Okay, yeah, that's... Not really.
Yeah. I don't know. I started cooking for a traditional French chef, and I think a lot of my food, kind of shows that. But there's also the traditions that Oliveto kind of stands for that we still follow.
So, I'm curious, Gunter, how did you get to Atlanta? Because landing in what is essentially the Deep South, I mean, how did that happen?
How do you go to Atlanta?
Yes.
Well, there are jobs, and you go where the jobs are, and you go where the opportunities are. You're not like out there for like, I'm going to be in this city or this city. It's where opportunities are. That's where you go. And it just happened to be that it was Atlanta.
Can I have a question? Who were the first investors and believers in restaurants? It was hotels, right? That were the first ones to make these big offers to bring people in from Europe?
I think at that time it was. I think, the scene has changed in that, of course. But at that time it was. So my opportunity was to work with Regent Hotels first, in Washington, where I met Jimmy and we worked together. And then later on was the Ritz-Carlton in Atlanta.
But you were talking about when food became important to people and product became important, and there was a time before Jean-Louis and before Gunther when people were just ignorant about product, and people like Jean-Louis would pick up a product he'd never seen before, and I would watch him, and he would taste it raw, and then he would saute a little bit and then taste it again, and then he'd make a great dish out of it. I mean, these guys had so much, you talk about tradition, they had so much 300-400 years of French tradition behind them, and this is what's so important to cuisine. I remember being in the kitchen with Gunther on opening week at the restaurant. It was the Mayfair restaurant in the Regent Hotel, and a purveyor comes in with a big old bag of carrots, and I remember Gunther, he ripped open the bag. I mean, it was like a 50-pound bag of carrots, and he pulls out a carrot the size of a baseball bat, and he goes, "Jimmy, what is this for a shit?" And I said, "Well, that's a carrot." And Gunther goes, "This is a carrot?" And he sliced it in half, and he smelled it, and he threw it back in the bag, and he told the guy, he says, "Take this shit back. I will not serve this in my restaurant." And I'm standing there going, what did you just do? It's a carrot, for God's sakes. But Gunther grew up in a family of produce growers in Germany. And he recognized that the American public was satisfied eating very mediocre product and garbage. One other quick story which changed my life. We met this company gastronome that had all of the great cheeses in the Washington, D.C. area. So the guy shows up with a dozen cheeses one day. And so Gunther walks over to accept them, and he picks up the cheese and he smells it. And he goes, "Yeah, this cheese is dead." Picks up a different one. "Yeah, this cheese is not even ready to eat yet." Picks up another one. "This cheese is shit." And he sends them all back. And the owner of the company calls up. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
The owner of the company calls up and says, why did you send all my cheeses back? Gunther says, "These cheeses were shit." He says, "I'm coming to visit you." So the next day we drove to Baltimore, Maryland, and visited the guy. And expecting to see, a half a dozen refrigerators of cheeses. And the guy's storing all the cheeses in one refrigerator, all at the same temperature. And Gunther walks in and says, "Yeah, this cheese should never be kept cold. This cheese, you put this blue cheese next to this cheese, it will kill this cheese. You're ruining your cheeses." Now, here's a guy that sells cheese for a living, had no idea about his product. And it took people like Jean-Louis and like Gunther and like the chefs that followed, and their knowledge and appreciation of great food to change the way we think about food.
Well, let's try this pizza before it gets. It's a temperature sensitive.
Yeah, we just a little bit of the Roberta's pizza just landed.
This is a pizza with anchovies. It's their famous original. Here.
So, Jonah, I think that product sourcing, especially in the Bay Area where you're located, it looks a little different today. I mean, if anything, there's kind of a running joke about the preciousness of produce. And as a chef, I mean, do you find that it's still an issue to find quality products, or is it there's so many competing and great quality products that you just have to make decisions based on, I don't know, personal relationships or other reasons?
Yeah, I think good product there has almost become kind of a given. Any restaurant you go to, you know, you'll get these buzzwords, locally sourced and that kind of stuff. And it's great to have access to all these differing products and, you know, really great products. But it's kind of annoying when, you know, you just want a certain type of food and you have to sort through all these cute phrases to really get to it. But no, it's great having access to all of it. And I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, where we had a lot of great farmers and farmers market every weekend. So I've always kind of taken it for granted. I've never had to deal with not being able to get the product I wanted or dealing with non-seasonal products.
I have a question. Were there any products, now you were from America, but Gunter, were there any products that you found in America that you were surprised by and that maybe excelled those of the European counterparts that you didn't expect when you got here?
Well, that's only today. That's not 25, 30 years ago. 25 or 30 years ago, there were tremendous treasures sitting somewhere, but nobody had any idea what they were, and they had no idea what it was. And so there was a lot of education going on, not only on the customer side. The most important thing was really to educate the producers. I was a major force in and a board of director in founding the Georgia Organic Farmers in 1989, for example. For us, the farm-to-table, that's a, you know, that is really where we're coming from. You know, this is not new. It is fantastic today that we see that the young chefs are like totally bought into that. That is fantastic, you know, because it could be a lot easier, you know, working with many different purveyors and farmers is also a lot of work. It is a lot of work on a daily basis. But at that time, it was really getting these people out there and do, because the potential was there. The waters are there. Look at the bounties of products you have in Maine, for example. But it wasn't available. I mean, and Jean-Louis is a main force in that, of course, got really these treasures that people made them. People made them available. And first, of course, there were only basically available to us, you know, a very few chefs. Today, they have tripled. They have grown up. We have products in America today. They're absolutely fantastic, you know, of course.
So, Gunter, I'm curious, you know, you're running a restaurant, you know, it's open, you have people coming in, you're having challenges kind of sourcing the products that are of the caliber that you are looking for. Well, you know, what do you do as a chef? Because ultimately, like, the ship has to go on, the show has to go on. Like, how do you deal with that?
Right, in the beginning, it was very difficult. Because in the beginning, you know, I came from a place where the product is the most important thing. You know, forget about the creativity, okay? There is it's really two things. It's the product and the execution. You know, creativity, great, okay? But the product in the execution is really what makes great food, what I think. And it was very, very difficult because we didn't have a product. You know, just to take, you know, Idaho potato, what the hell are you going to do with it? You know, so it was very difficult. And I can feel for Prushnikov when he came over to America to teach ballet. It's a very similar story, I can tell you that. And he made a famous ballet out of it. And so we had to change. We had to, you know, work with what we had, but we also, at the same time, we had to go out of that and enhance, you know, producers. And there were already little guys there.
To contextualize, yeah. Gunther's wife is a ballerina, so I think that's where you picked up that analogy.
Right.
So I guess I'm just curious, too, like one of the things we have another show on the network called The Morning After, and on The Morning After they have the segment called Chardonnays, where it's like the fictional restaurant dedicated to like all bad food trends. And so I'm curious, because you guys have been cooking throughout a couple of decades, I'm sure you've seen some trends that you embrace and trends that you would prefer to forget. And I wonder if maybe you could share with us a couple of dishes that stick out in your mind from the like late 70s, 80s, early 90s that were particularly great or particularly bad that we just don't really see around anymore.
Well, for hundreds of years, it was all about traditional French cuisine when you're talking about Western cuisine. And you followed the rules. Escoffier made the rules. You know, Carême made the rules. And he didn't break those rules. And then in the mid-70s, early to mid-70s, these chefs in France and in Germany and Italy, they started breaking all the rules. And they invented this cuisine called Nouvelle Cuisine. And Nouvelle Cuisine died, as it should. But what it did was it allowed chefs to start thinking outside the box. You were talking about dishes. Who was it? Sandorin's or somebody did lobster with a vanilla sauce, but it was a savory vanilla sauce. Somebody else did a loin of rabbit with a chocolate sauce, but it was a bitter, earthy chocolate sauce. And this wasn't allowed under the old rules of French cuisine. But now, because of the trend of the 70s, they were breaking out. They were serving halibut with beet sauce and just crazy combinations, and that was a great thing. Because from that point on, I believe that was the start of the culinary revolution in the world, of Western cuisine. From that point on, go with your senses. You know, create a dish that feels good to you, not that follows some old French guy's rules.
Are there any dishes that you remember cooking a lot and just really loving?
You know, I agree with Gunther. It's really all about product,
yeah,
and about execution. So, you know, dishes that stand out in my mind are the soft-shell crabs I got in Urbana, Virginia, that the moment they molted, the moment they shed, you would take them out and lightly saute them and eat them with a fresh pasta. I've never had a better plate of food in my life, but that's not because of any real talent. It's really because of spectacular product and good execution.
Is that the Chesapeake Bay? I mean, is that like a real producer of delicious fish and crabs and all that? Is that like a great terroir?
Who is he exactly?
No, but I mean, yeah. Chesapeake, isn't that right by D.C.?
Yeah, the Chesapeake Bay's, you know, it's got stunning fish from the most beautiful striped bass and hard shell, soft shell crabs and oysters. And sure, it's a bounty of seafood.
Yeah.
But you'll find that in different areas of the country. You know, they specialize in different products. But it's all about product, and it's all about execution. You know, the recipe for great food, great product, season it right, cook it right.
Yeah.
You've got a great meal. And when a chef like Gunther or Jean-Louis goes out to dinner, they're not looking to be wowed with towers of beautiful, you know, sprouts and, you know, things going in different directions. They're looking for food that has been treated with respect and tastes good.
Tell us the roller coaster of Jimmy Sneed. So what's the legend of Jimmy? What happened? So from D.C., give us the headlines. Where what brings you to Roberta's today? Tell us headlines of everything in between, because you've worked at a lot of different, did a lot of different things.
Yeah, but we have a dinner tonight, and this, this would be about a three-hour story. Just to say that, you know, I got started at the Four Seasons Hotel was the first good job I ever had. I'd had plenty of shitty jobs, but the Four Seasons Hotel really taught me discipline and respect. And then working with Jean-Louis taught me about the intense passion of cooking. And then working with Gunther Seeger taught me about the not just the precision of cooking, but looking inside the flavor of your product. I mean, if the truth be told, and Jean-Louis has been dead a long time, so I can say this, he can make anything taste good because he was big into salt, good freshly ground black pepper, great olive oil, high quality butter, garlic. He could make anything taste great, and he cooked with a fierce passion. Gunther would pick something up and he would look at it and he would taste it and say, yeah, this is a little rich, so I need something a little acidic to balance it. He's more, I don't want to say scientific, but he's more precise in his cooking, and the result is something so spectacular that frankly a lot of people don't understand it. And the people that admired Gunther's food the most were the great chefs that I knew. You know, they would come to me and say, oh my God, Gunther's food is 3-star Michelin, 4-star Michelin, you know.
So on that note, Gunther, any you know, memorable, good or bad, like dishes that you could share, maybe something that we're just not seeing in the New York area or in the national kind of food consciousness?
I don't think it's about that we haven't seen anything like that, you know. I think it's evolution. I think it's experience. And there is, of course, a technical part to that in cooking. But, you know, you can get recipes in about 20 seconds, any recipe you want today. So it's a different, we're in a different stage. But it's still the intellect of food, you know, we still, I think, need to work on, you know, that we need to see the deeper part of that, the cultural part of that. So there's still room, you know, and you know, are there better dishes than others in my world? Yeah, of course there were, but it was evolution. It was working on them, you know. They weren't made to blow somebody's mind. They were just made to be great food, you know.
Well, I have a question. If you could just describe the difference, what is the spectrum of 3-star Michelin food? Like, what is the differences amongst them, and what was your, where did you fall within that? Like, almost, I don't know if it's to ask you what an ideal meal was, but how many courses, how does it unveil, really, from the grammar of the food?
Well, that's a very individual opinion, you know, we could have about this. What's 3-star Michelin and what's not, specifically today? There were, you know, in the history, in the, there were 3-star Michelins, of course, had a certain frame with it, and you had to fit it, that frame, and which means, you know, 1 Michelin star is this, 2 Michelin star is that, 3 Michelin star is that. I think that has changed as well, and I think that's it's good. You know, it's good in a sense that it gives chefs more freedom now. They don't need to have, not everybody needs to have the Christopher Silber and a big linen and so on. So it's it has become more individualized, I think.
What's the classic? What is?
Well, the classic were like you needed to have a certain cuisine. And that was, of course, French. And then you needed to have a very luxurious dining room. You needed to have a very luxurious service. But that's changed. And I think it's a good thing, you know. maybe the bad thing is, you know, if there's one, is that we still, and for me it's always very important that we look back, we look where we're coming from. And of course, there's always an evolution, but you know, we can't ignore that. So because somebody gets 3 Michelin star and you have a stainless steel counter, it still needs to have integrity. It still needs to have great food. It still needs to have great hospitality. And I don't think you wouldn't get 3 stars otherwise. But it has loosened up tremendously, specifically in America. So we also have different... our clientele has changed. I think, which is a fantastic thing to see for myself, is that I go in a great restaurant, you see people in their 20s eating there. And it's not necessary that everybody is a billionaire of these 25-year-olds, you know. So what that means is that there is more interest. There is a culture here now where it is totally incredible that younger people have bought into that and see it as a life. It's a style of life, if I can say that, you know. It's not because only the billionaires can afford to eat like that. So it has really spread out.
Variety is the spice of life, right? Jonah, I think we're just about out of time here, but Jonah, I wanted to give you the opportunity. I'm just curious, you know, at Olivetta, you have your upstairs menu, you have your downstairs menu, you've got your special dinner series, you guys are doing so many things, and maybe if you could just share with us, you know, some highlights of like what you're really excited to be cooking in right now in the kitchen.
Right now, birds. We've been getting some really nice birds, and we actually have a bird dinner coming up either late March or early April. We recently got these guinea hen from a small winery, actually, but the woman that runs it just started raising guinea hen for fun, and they're just beautiful birds, about 2 pounds. We bring them in, hang them for about a week in our meat locker, and then do a variety of things with them. But that kind of inspired an all-bird dinner. Like you mentioned, we have the themed dinners. We just finished our whole hog dinner, which is an all-pork menu. And so, to mix it up a little bit, I get a little tired of pork after that. We're doing a bird dinner. And we'll have quite a few different birds. Geese, guinea hen, we get really beautiful pigeon, a few other things, and a whole menu based on that. So that's what I'm excited about doing right now, but I don't know, there's always something new happening. We have a lot of farmers that we've been working with for a long time, and they're always sending me emails offering us things that they don't so much mass produce or, you know, offer to other restaurants, so that's fun.
I call goose ribeye in the sky. That's how much I love geese. But can you talk about, I'm sure everyone wants to know, are there any commonalities between driving race cars, which I know you do on the side, and working in the kitchen?
Yeah, I guess so. What was that quote you said earlier about me driving race cars?
That he's sexier?
Oh, right. I say I'm 1%. I'm 99% heterosexual, but that 1% that's gay is remotely attracted to Jonah right now.
Just so we
now
got that
I know he's a race car driver. That's intense, man. Race car driving is a tough job.
Thank you. Since we got that out of the way. No, I mean, I guess they're both...
I was joking. They brought it up. I had to say what I said. Stand by it.
I agree with you. I mean, it's pretty sexy. No, I don't know. I mean, there is that... high intensity, fast paced aspect to both. You find a lot of passionate people in both fields. I would, I don't know. I'd like to think that I was good at both. I'm not sure I'm that great of a race car driver, but I have fun doing it, so.
Give it a little time.
What do you
anyway
ride? What's the type of car and how fast?
Last season I was driving a Nissan 370Z. Actually got Rookie of the Year in SCCA, so that was cool. And then this year I'm going to be driving a Spec Racer Ford, which is a little factory built race car, about 1800 or 1700 pounds, 109 horsepower, and all of them are exactly the same. It's pretty competitive. You've got about 60 of those cars in a field, and they're all exactly the same. So it's really the driver that determines, you know, the winner.
Not
circular race?
No, it's all road courses. Sears Point, Laguna Seca, Watkins Glen, all those type of classic road courses.
Awesome. Well, thank you everyone so much for joining us. It's been a super interesting session, and we hope that you all come back soon to talk a little bit more shop. Joe. Cue the music, Joe. We're going to take us out.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.